Go. All right.
Great. All right. Thank you all for coming out today. My name is Joshua Tucker. I'm the director of the Jordan Center and also a politics professor here at NYU. Yeah, it's great pleasure to welcome the kickoff event of Yevgenia's spring series today. And it's also an incredible pleasure to welcome Michael here. And just to introduce our speakers today, so Yevgenia Albats is a research professor in the NYU Department of Russian and Slavic Studies. She's an investigative journalist, political scientist, author, and radio host. Since getting her PhD in political science, you can ask her who one of her classmates was when she was doing that, from Harvard University. She has split her time between academia and journalism. Dr. Albats was previously a distinguished journalist in residence at the Jordan Center from 2022 to 23. She's also been a media and democracy fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School and a fellow at the Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies at Harvard. She teaches political science at the Harvard Extension School and is the author of four independently researched books, including The State Within the State, KGB, and Its Hold on Russia, Past, Present, and Future. Our guest today is Michael Kaufman, who is a senior fellow in the Russian and Eurasian program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where he focuses on the Russian military, Ukrainian armed forces, and Eurasian security issues. Prior to joining Carnegie in 2023, he served as the director of the Russian Studies program at the Center for Naval Analyses, where he led a team conducting research on the capability, strategy, and military thought of the Russian armed forces. Widely recognized as one of the leading authorities on the Russian military and the Russian-Ukrainian war, Kaufman has led foundational work in the field and is routinely cited in major publications. And I can say, for some of you who attended virtually our New York City Russia Public Policy series, which we did collaboratively with Columbia, I can say, and after the invasion, we did multiple, things over the years on the war. When we were listing out the people who we wanted to get on to come and give us expertise on what was going on the ground on the military side of things, Michael was always on the top of the list. So this point about him being widely recognized is 100% on. Aside from his work at Carnegie, Kaufman is a contributing editor at War on the Rocks. And if you don't haven't checked out War on the Rocks, you should definitely check out War on the Rocks, where he hosts Russia Contingency, a bi-weekly podcast on the Russian military and the Russian-Ukraine war. He previously served as a research fellow and program manager at the National Defense University, and past fellowships have included the Modern War Institute at West Point, Center for New American Security, and the Woodrow Wilson Center. So please join me in welcoming Yevgenia Albats and Michael Kaufman to the
Hello. Josh, thank you so much. Thank you very much for your very kind presentation. And of course, Josh Tucker, we were in the same class at Harvard in 1994. Yes, it was life ago. Anyway, but first of all, as I do any time I cover events in Ukraine, I would like to express my most sincere condolences to all those whose loved ones were killed or wounded or have made to suffer from Holodomor in Kyiv and other cities as a result of the evil one that can't is a result of the evil deeds of the country of which I am a citizen of. And I feel angry and ashamed, and I ask for your acceptance of my sincere apologies. So that's what I would like to say first and foremost. Now I have to make a confession that even though I am a journalist, I was in Ukraine already when the war started in March of 2023, and I drove through entire Ukraine from Khmelnytsky, from which my family is, to all the way to Nikolaev and Odessa and Kherson. Still, I'm totally at loss. I really don't understand anymore. Why we have this war going for 4 years, 4-year-long war. This war has already lasted longer than the so-called Great Patriotic War, the war of USSR with Nazi Germany, which started in June 1941 and ended on May 8th or 9th in the Russian way of 1945. And that's why, and I'm extremely, and I read everything I can read. I read each and every report. I read Ukrainian papers. I read Russian papers. I read New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and I watch everything that I can. And still, I don't understand. So, what are the odds that Putin will win? Can Europe allow for that to happen? What are the realities of the front lines? Will the Ukrainian military accept a peace deal that involves the loss of territory? That is why, as Josh mentioned, I really like to see here Michael Kaufman, who may answer those and many other questions. Michael is originally from Kyiv, speaks the language, and has been frequently to front lines since the start of the war. He gets his information directly from actors on the ground, not from reading newspapers as most of us do. Before we proceed to Dr. Kaufman's presentation, I would like to bring a little bit of human touch to this event and suggest you to watch a very short footage of once booming Ukrainian city of Ugledar. It was the city of 15,000 people, booming city, very much involved with all kind of energy related industries. 30% of those who lived in Ugledar, they were Russian speakers. So now it is a dead city with 25, 2-5, still residing in Ugledar. 2-5. Moreover, there are now hundreds of cities and towns like Ugledar in central, southern, and eastern Ukraine. So now, Michael, the floor is all yours.
Okay. Again, thank you for a kind introduction. Maybe if we can get the PowerPoint presentation back. I brought you a few slides with just maps as reference because sometimes it's helpful to have maps as reference. So if we can get to the first slide, I don't want the data to distract. There we go. Thanks. Thanks a lot. So, look, thanks for the kind invitation. I'm sorry I'm late. Amtrak was really late today. Amtrak has never been on time in my life, so it's not a surprise. Like, today should be no different. So I just barely just made it here from the train station. I'm gonna spend some time today covering the current battlefield dynamics, what happened in 2025, and a bit about the current situation as we head, now into 2026. This is the fifth year of the war. I focus on defense issues. I'm a military analyst. I spend quite a bit of time doing field work in Ukraine, about every three and a half months or so. I hope that this is going to prove interesting to you, even if you don't deal with defense matters. I tend to talk about these topics very clinically, but I'm sure you understand that this fundamentally is about people. And hopefully you take something away from it, or maybe at the very least you take away from the fact that you don't want to work in defense or be a defense analyst, and that's perfectly fine too. A bit of kind of the bottom front. Before I get into that, so I put the shot up. This is from Bakhmut. This is March 1st, 2023. Skimming the rooftops. This is not a newspaper photo. This is from my phone. This is from my time during Battle of Bakhmut. I thought I'd add something as like a personal touch that maybe you hadn't seen before. And most of the rest of this will just be maps from Deep State or my colleagues in Blackbird groups that will do OSINT analysis and conflict mapping. So very briefly. First on 2025, I'm going to go through what happened, what the battlefield dynamic is, and what we see at the start of 26. In 2025, Ukraine did better than expected from my point of view. Russian forces took more territory than in 2024, and they did push Ukrainian military out of Kursk, but they advanced actually very slowly along the axis they prioritized, the main operational directions that they were investing in. And a lot of the territory they took was of relatively low value, meaning they didn't take any major cities. Their unrecoverable casualties, these are the casualties that we care about as analysts. That is, people who are killed or seriously injured such that they cannot return to combat duty. Not people who are just injured, because in war, people get injured many times and come back to military service. So their unrecoverable casualties went up quite a bit last year. And they paid a very steep price for the territory they gained. The Russian gains were very incremental, and so they had tactical advances, but really no operationally significant breakthroughs. As I'm sure everyone can see, they failed to capture Donetsk by the end of the year once again. We should go back a little bit to 2024 to understand how we got here, because we need to know the past in order to discuss the future. Because I want to save the Q&A, obviously, for 2026 and where we're going, but let's use our time collectively to talk a bit about like where we've been in this war for the last year and a half or so. So in 2024, After the Battle of Avdiivka, which is earlier part of 2024, the Russian military chose to focus on fighting primarily by using assault infantry detachments with increasingly smaller sized groups. And they were employed as expendable assault force that they could regenerate. They set up a pipeline of newly contracted personnel, and they were contracting a lot of people per month, giving them about 2 weeks of training on average, and then sending them to these assault units. And they were just replenishing the assault units within the force and using them as a kind of constant assault layer. The reason for this was partly poor force quality, low force training overall, so that the Russian military really struggled to conduct larger scale mechanized assaults. They'd lost the better part of the force in 2022 and hadn't had time to recover. But also, they really struggled to overcome traditional prepared defense, okay? Trenches, anti-tank barriers, minefields, backed by mass precision, right? Drones really started to shut down the battle space by fall of 2023, and it became very hard for vehicles in order to achieve any kind of breakthrough or to get within 5 kilometers of the front line. And since 23, that's really expanded to then 10 kilometers of the front line, and even further in many cases, more like 15. And now you're really in a danger zone today, probably looking around 20 to 25, right? So this started out like a few kilometers, and it grew into a much larger drone kill zone. And so the Russian military focused on trying to grind their way to the front. And I kind of refer to this as a negative adaptation, essentially majoring in the minors. They couldn't conduct large-scale combat operations, so they were doing lots of small-scale combat operations every day with lots of infantry units across a very broad 1,200-kilometer front. And the advantage and disadvantage, I'll get to that in a minute, of the Russian approach, was that on the one hand, they could sustain this offensive pace for most of the year. If you see the Russian military is on the offensive pretty much from about end of February all the way through December, okay? Typically, this time of year, January, February, is not an operational pause, but a slower pace of combat operations. But they're on the offensive for much of the year because they're grinding their way through the front, and this offensive is very difficult to exhaust. The drawbacks are extensive, and I will get to that in this talk, where you can basically see how little they've been managing to accomplish over the last 2 years and over the course of 2025. So Ukraine adapted this approach successfully in 24, focusing on drone units, initially to compensate for a lack of artillery shells and a deficit of manpower. But then they really organized how they fight around drones and drone units as the main form of fire support, as the best way to deny Russia the ability to maneuver on the battlefield, and is a much better and more efficient way to basically try to contain any Russian advances. And this was used in combination with mines and traditional artillery. It's not just drones. If you were to take minefields out of this battle space, if you were to take traditional artillery out of it, drones by themselves wouldn't be having nearly the same impact. So I want to make clear to people it's not just drones. But the fact that drones are now responsible for 70-80% plus of the casualties and attrition is due to these effects and also due to how the Russian military is fighting. Okay. And so the drones allow Ukrainian militaries to establish a very effective engagement and defeat zone around their positions, and Russian advances slowed down quite a bit in winter of 2024, heading into 2025. And as we get into 2025, you see Russian military try to adapt to these developments in three ways. First, they built out their own offensive line of drones, a bit taking the idea from Ukraine's defensive line of drones. They deployed elite drone formations, namely Rubicon, which is a training and development center, but also a series of elite drone companies in support of their units, again, taking some of the ideas from elite Ukrainian drone units. And they really started to focus on Ukraine's drone units much more so than Ukraine's infantry, and reducing Ukraine's advantage in drone employment considerably over the course of 2025. The second is Russian forces switched to infiltration tactics. So if we saw 2024 being a year where they largely abandoned large-scale mechanized assault and start to switch to a lot of infantry assault groups, by 2025, what we see is it's dramatically reduced use of equipment in general, of any kind of mechanized equipment. And we go from having assault infantry to now the main focus being infiltration. And what is infiltration? It's essentially small groups of infantry. I'm talking two men at a time, okay? But many of them, advancing to penetrate to Ukrainian positions. And so they're not even trying to attack Ukraine's infantry in the front. They're trying to just walk through it to get behind them, then accumulate in the rear, and then attack the supporting units and displace the Ukrainian forward positions. Okay. And I'll get to why that's happening. But we now see basically very dispersed tactics of lots of small numbers of infantry, one man, two men, trying to wait, make their way on their own. And then if they get somewhere, being sent another person's reinforcement and another person's reinforcement and accumulate behind the front line.
And they get there unnoticed. Ukrainians don't see them.
I would say that on average, maybe 70% of them don't make it. However, if you take a platoon and you divide this platoon into two-man groups, you will quickly get 15 two-man groups. And if, let's say, 30, 20% of these people do make it at most, okay, if they do make it, that's already several men. And then another platoon will be sent. And if another 20% of them make it, that's already a bunch of soldiers that have accumulated in the rear. The Ukrainian military uses drones and tries to hunt down every soldier they see. And I've spending a lot of time in with them can see that because Ukraine has so little infantry at the front, and the unit is largely defending with drones rather than any manpower they have available, it's very important for them that nobody gets through. Because if somebody does get through, that's now somebody that's in the rear. And if any more soldiers get through, they could easily be in trouble. And they don't necessarily have the troops available to counterattack. So there's a drone units are focused to try to account for every soldier they saw, and to make sure that they actually got every soldier that they saw advance. But yes, a small percentage does get through. And the problem is it's a daily set of assaults. So while a unit is trying to, let's say, sort out this attack, another wave attack is already coming, and some percentage of those troops will get through. Okay. And sometimes it's not easy. So in the summer, this is much easier. Why? You have terrain cover, you have trees. Things heat up, so it's very hard to see things on thermal. Russian troops use thermal capes, thermal cloaks that in some cases hide them and protect them from thermal imaging, right? And they advance very slowly. In the winter, it's much harder for infiltration tactics to work, which is why you typically see a significant slowdown. There's nowhere to hide in the winter, and there's nowhere to hide from thermal imaging in the winter, right? The drawback of the winter for drone units is the winter has a lot worse weather. The conditions for drone operations are poor. But in general, it's much harder for infantry to advance in the winter. I'm happy to get more into this. And so the short answer is yes, some of them get through, and it doesn't take many for it to become a problem.
Those who don't, they killed, wounded, or just retreat.
Okay. So at this point of the war, the odds that you will be killed in action in an assault are incredibly high because drones make it impossible to recover casualties, and drones inflict a form of point damage. So if we started at the beginning of this war was defined by artillery. And because both of these armies are traditional artillery armies, they're both successors to the Soviet military, which is an artillery army. Like Russian military and Soviet militaries are culturally artillery armies. The casualty ratios were such, artillery inflicts a lot of wounded for the number of killed. So you had lots of people who were wounded in the early periods of this war relative to those that were killed. At this stage of the war, the casualty figures look very, very different for both sides, but especially for Russia. Now, the ratio of killed is very high, and the ratio of seriously injured, unrecoverable losses is also almost like 1 to 1. And there's a much smaller number of lightly wounded. Why? Because drones have made it very difficult for anyone to survive on this battlefield, and they made it almost impossible for anyone to extract you from the battlefield, also, right? So if you are seriously injured at the front line, the odds that you will be recovered are much lower, and the odds that that injury will be fatal are much higher. Okay. So casualties have switched considerably in that there's a much higher percentage amongst Russian forces of those killed. And those seriously injured are almost even with those killed. Okay. As opposed to like a 3 to 1 ratio. And sorry for folks like for whom casualties might be a complex topic, but so you understand the battlefield dynamic really alters what casualties look like and the numbers killed versus the numbers who are just injured. And at this stage, it's very hard to recover anyone from battle space. That's why Ukraine in particular tries to, on one hand, minimize the number of troops that they have, but also really struggles with the very low density of forces. I'll get into this in a second. So the Russian military also tried supplementing these attacks with lightly motorized assaults rather than doing traditional mechanized assaults. And by lightly motorized assaults, I mean motorcycles and dune buggies. I call this the Mad Max approach. And we saw a lot of this over the course of 2025. In some places, it did actually show them a bit better results than traditional armored assaults, but it didn't make that much of a difference. You saw some Ukrainian units like Skala 425 adopt this tactic. Generally, the idea was the same, to try to get their units past the initial Ukrainian lines and to use motorcycles to get past the drone engagement zone and then to find a way to entrench themselves behind Ukrainian positions, to get into some town, to get into some tree line and just entrench there. Other things that changed in 2025, there was significant concentration of glide bomb strikes, a much better use of them in support of Russian attacks, and a steady technological shift in how Shahed drones are being used. For those who are familiar with you with large one-way attack drones called Shahed, Russians call their version Garand. These are used in large numbers against Ukrainian infrastructure, but what a lot of people don't know is in 2025, they were increasingly used dynamically against frontline targets, that is, tactically against battlefield targets at the front line. And increasingly, you've seen them, most recently seen them hit a Ukrainian passenger train. That's actually not new. They started hitting passenger trains in Chernihiv last year and by Sumy. So meaning these, at certain ranges, these drones are dynamically employed and are able to target moving things, as opposed to just hitting buildings or
So it's
infrastructure.
not an accident. It wasn't an accident that Russians hit the train
Three
mid-second
Shaheds hit the
effect.
train.
So
Three.
they did it on
Of
purpose.
course.
And they
Yeah.
knew that there were just passengers there.
They hit a moving train with three drones. I mean, then it's very clear. They've done this several times, though. Just to be clear, it's not the first train they've hit. They've hit plenty of them just closer to Russia, and now they're able to hit them at longer ranges. The only difference is that they were able to reach this train further in Ukraine. Okay. Okay. So, and like I said, these drones are at shorter ranges. They can use them to hit moving targets. In fact, most recently we saw them actually hit a HIMARS MLRS while basically on the move. This was about 2 weeks ago, I think now. Okay. So current battlefield dynamic is really defined by porous lines, okay? Where Ukrainian forces in their forward positions, they're essentially pickets with large gaps in between. Often you'll see maybe 9 men per kilometer. And so essentially you have 3 men and 3 men and 3 men with a lot of distance between them. I'm sure if you can understand, if you go out, if between you and the next person in the tree line, there's hundreds of meters, you don't really control the space. Okay. These positions are not firing positions. Why? Because at the front line, if you reveal yourself, you will immediately be hit by drones and artillery from the other side. They will spare no amount of drones for you. The number of drones currently on the battlefield exceeds the number of people by a very large number because both sides use millions of drones. Okay. So the number of drones available exceeds people and equipment by a very substantial number. Nobody's going to spare 5, 10 drones to try to kill one person. Right. So this is why these positions are not even firing positions. They're basically pickets marking the point on the map. Drones conduct all the intelligence and they do a lot of the actual sort of fire support and defense, and troops generally don't come out of these positions to fight unless absolutely necessary. So, they're essentially a series of pickets. Russian forces, seeing this, basically try to walk past them and try to find the route to just walk past these positions. And Ukrainian drones try to pick them up either forward of these positions or in the back of them, okay? And there's substantial space between this forward line of pickets and the secondary lines and what have you. But these are not defensive lines. What I'm basically trying to tell you is that this is not World War I with drones. There are no trenches being held by a large number of people in them. Okay. You will not find this anywhere in the battle space, right? There are trenches, but there's nobody in them. There are no people holding these forward positions. It would be impossible to support them because of drones. There would be no way for you to resupply your people. People at the front line are resupplied with drones, heavy multi-rotor drones, drop them their food, their water. In good areas, troops rotate every 1 to 2 months, but in bad areas, people sit in those positions for many months. Some people sit there, well, I won't get into how long, but a very long period of time. Why? Because you're much more likely to get killed going to your position and from it, right? So you're going to take about 3 days on foot to move up to your position to take it is going to be very dangerous, and you're not going to want to leave it unless you have to, because that's the greatest likelihood you face of being killed by a drone. All right, so people hold these positions for a very long time.
Then how do they get the supply?
By drone.
By drone.
Yeah, it drops it. Yeah, we'll drop it. Yeah, by drone. They get batteries, they get food, they get water, they get resupplied by drone. Yeah, absolutely. And increasingly in Ukraine, also by UGV, right? Uncrewed ground vehicle, which can
What
bring a
is
lot
UGV?
more. Uncrewed ground vehicle, NRK.
Oh.
UGV. Uncrewed ground vehicle, this is essentially, think of it as another drone, another operator drone, but actually can deliver a much larger number of goods too. Okay. Increasingly, particularly the past year, what we've seen is a great expansion of UGV units across the Ukrainian military using UGVs to do logistics. Why? If logistics becomes the most dangerous job, then what do you want to do? You want to try to get people out of that job, right? Like, why get people killed trying to bring supplies to other people? You want the job to be maximally done by machines that are operated by people rather than by people themselves, okay? What's basically happens that because of this lack of cohesive defensive lines, it makes it very hard to tell who controls what, right, at the battlefield. And so basically the contact line is much more of a gray area of overlapping engagement zones between drone units, and positions are really marble. So at this point in this war for the past year, presence doesn't confer control, right? And so you end up in a situation where, I'll give you an example. You like look at the city of Kupiansk, and you have 150 Russians in basements in Kupiansk, and technically they're there, but they don't actually control anything in the city, right? So Russian troops report to their own military that yes, they control this part of Kupiansk on a map. They've shaded it as their own, but in reality, they don't control anything. They're sitting in basements. They can't come out. Ukrainian positions are commingled with their positions, and now good luck figuring out who controls what, like within the city. Because in the middle of the city, nobody controls anything and nobody can move for fear of being killed by a drone, right? And you control space as much as you control anything sitting inside your basement, not being able to look out, right? Like, do you control your street like that? No. So, and often you get this commingling in tree lines also, right? Being during the summer where you can have Ukrainian units and Russian units so close in a dense tree line that, it's a gray area. And increasingly, analysts have started to shade a lot of the front line for several kilometers. It's just gray because you can't really say that anybody present there controls the space. So superiority in drone support became essential to establish initiative on the ground, and this is the contest that's now much more relevant to shaping outcomes, at least at the tactical level in this war, compared to traditional artillery. And 2025 was essentially a tug of war over the drone engagement zone. It's basically a zone that, let's say, spans at least 25 kilometers from the front line in either direction. 2025 started with it being much more squarely over the Russian military, with Ukraine having a big advantage. And over the course of 2025, the Russian military shifted it much more over Ukrainian military, so that now there's a degree of parity. That advantage hasn't disappeared, but it was reduced considerably. However, look, the Russian military has not been able to take advantage of that because the way they're fighting is very cost ineffective. Infiltration tactics are very costly in terms of the people lost, and doesn't really allow a force to generate any kind of momentum on the battlefield. Like, there's no way attacking somebody with two people at a time to generate battlefield momentum to get a breakthrough and to exploit that breakthrough. You just can't get there with these kind of tactics, right? And in 2025, as I said, casualties shifted quite a bit from infantry for the first time in this war to support personnel, to drone units, to those doing logistics. That's why Ukraine ramped up use of UGVs, and it's really still in the lead in use of UGVs compared to Russian forces. And you see Ukraine really trying to maximize attrition of Russian personnel as one of the areas of focus. Another one's expanding their ability to attack in the rear where most of the support is. Because Ukraine's challenge is that at about 30 kilometers, so a lot of their strike abilities really fall off. And trying to get more and more deeper strike abilities has been one of their goals past year. The big challenge I see for Ukrainian forces is that it's much less about tech innovation and much more about systematic employment of the capabilities and forces they have, not just to get attrition, not just to kill enemy forces, but to achieve specific outcomes, right? Battlefield outcomes. And a lot of that has to do with scaling capabilities like air defense units with drone interceptors, for example. Last year, Ukraine had a big breakthrough. There is a very cheap way to intercept the drones that Russia employs. Interceptor drones cost only a couple thousand dollars a piece. Used with tactical radars, if scaled, they work. They intercept a lot of things. They're much cheaper than any kind of missile, and they're fairly easy to use. It's just a matter of scaling and deployment, meaning even though Russia dramatically ramped up attacks with one-way attack drones last year, especially Shahed, if you looked at summer 24, you were seeing maybe 500, 600 per month, and by summer 25, you're seeing well over that per night. So you would see thousands per month. You would see 5,500 maybe per month or something like that. So it's a really dramatic increase. The technology is also available to intercept these drones too, right? And it's scalable and producible. Okay, briefly on the two forces, a little bit on Russia. So challenge Russia will face, I think, this year is manpower. They continue to recruit a large number of personnel per month. They probably are not going to need to mobilize again, but they have to now get these people in lots of interesting kind of coercive ways. The force quality keeps going down. Desertion really went up in the Russian military last year, okay? Because the people they are getting are lower and lower quality. Because many of the people who wanted to take the money to fight already did it in the course of previous years, and now they're really struggling to maintain these numbers, and a much larger share of the people they get end up deserting. And the force quality keeps going down, even though the numbers look like they're overall steady if you look at Russian recruitment.
400,000 a month, right? No, 40,000.
Per year. You
So
mean
per
per year?
year, four
So
hundred thousand a year.
per month, let's say crudely give or take 35,000. Last year they had a quota of recruiting 403,000 men. And they were doing okay until about the fall. They really started to struggle meeting their monthly numbers starting September of last year. And their casualties went up quite a bit in the last 3 months. The exact same thing happened in 2024, actually. Part of the reason for that, I suspect, right? I don't know as a supposition, is they substantially increased the intensity of offensive operations in the last couple of months of the war before the winter sets in. And often, just my own personal observation, you know, somebody who's followed the Russian military for a while, it's because they claim successes on the battlefield that they didn't actually achieve.
Do you want to show us a map?
Yeah, and then have to try to achieve them by the end of the year. Let me see if I can get this thing. I got it. I got it. One second. So apparently, all right. So yeah. So here we kind of. If you look where Russian military primarily was trying to advance over the course of 2025, the priority was naturally Donetsk. And what they've been trying to do for since 24 now is to try to take Donetsk into an operational development without fighting for the conglomeration of cities. This is Slavyansk, Kramatorsk, Druzhkivka, Konstakha, and as sort of call it. And this right here is Chasiv Yar. And so what they've been trying to do is come through Pokrovsk here by Dobropetya and come around behind the cities this way, and then come over the top here. As you see here, they had slow advances but greater success. Get past Siversk, Tuliman, and then get around behind Slavyansk and envelop it instead of having to fight for all these cities. And that's been the priority. The two secondary axes, where they made most of the gains last year, was actually here at the connection between Dnipro, Zaporizhia, and Donetsk, right here. And because here, this is a secondary theater, there's far fewer towns and much more open terrain, and Ukrainian units over here, let's say in terms of like strength and cohesion, much weaker, although you have a lot of naval infantry trying to hold things here. And secondarily, up here, okay? And this is kind of the connection between different Ukrainian regional groupings of forces, and this is a more problematic area. In Kupiansk, they advanced, but the situation there was stable the whole time. I was by there myself last October, November, when Gerasimov was announcing how he had all these units in encirclement, and I'll be honest, it was pretty funny because they had basically nothing. They had 150 plus maybe men in Kupiansk, and at this point, the Ukrainian counteroffensive had already largely severed their northern access route to the city, so they were getting a bit stuck. And since then, Ukraine has actually been able to take a lot back in Kupiansk, and this was, I think, generally failure for Russia. And then I'm happy to talk about Pokrovsky. People have questions on that specifically, but you've all seen the fight for Pokrovsky play out essentially almost the last 2 years.
And this is a dead city now already, Pokrovsk.
Yeah, well, Pokrovsky was a dead city, to tell you the truth. I used to be there. I used to stay there. Pokrovsk has been de facto a dead city since fall of 24. It was evacuated and it stopped being useful as a transit hub at that point. But Ukraine has held Pokrovsk remarkably over the course of 25, and Russian military have been working going around it north and southwest like this.
But what is the point of fighting for Pokrovsk if it is a dead city? And I understand that Ukrainians are losing a lot of people there. What's the point?
The point is that without taking Pokrovsk, you can't advance further on the southern axis of the operational development. And because they have been given a priority to take all of Donetsk, okay? And there's
Right.
no way of doing that without doing one of two things. Either you fight straight shot from Bakhmut to Kramatorsk, and we've seen how that's been going for them over the course of several years. They barely made it to a part of Chasiv Yar, okay? Or you take the operational development route, which is what they've been trying to do, and you can see how that's been working for the Russian military very slowly. But to do that, you have to get to Pokrovsk. Okay, and they've also been fighting for quite a bit to try to take Konstantinovka. The reality is that Ukraine fortified Pokrovsk back in 24, and essentially this was going to be a set piece battle. The Russian military for a long time basically got stumped on the defensive line here and tried to go around it. And then this summer, they, through infiltration, increasingly got into the city. And I'll talk in a little bit why that happened, but a situation that really started to deteriorate there rather rapidly over the course of the summer, heading into the fall. And then it looked like Pokrovsk was completely going to be lost. Ukrainian forces counterattacked and now hold just the northern edge of the city. But I mean, I'll be honest, I think that Ukraine is trying to maximize Russian losses for this battle, although it's quite clear where this battle is going and how it's going to end. But the truth is that if Ukraine gives up Pokrovsk, it essentially will have to give up maybe 15 kilometers of terrain around it, but it's not going to lead to a defensive collapse of Donetsk at all, meaning like nothing terrible is going to happen with the loss of Pokrovsk. And
Do you understand, correct me if I'm wrong,
no.
that Putin's goal is to conquer, to occupy the entire Donetsk Oblast? Because now, Russians, they occupy 95% of the entire Luhansk Oblast and this 95 or so percent of Donetsk Oblast. And the idea is that's why they're requesting Ukrainians to withdraw from this 5% that is still under Ukrainian control, no?
Let me clarify. I think they control 99% of Luhansk and about 75 to 76% of Donetsk. And here's the problem. This is where percentages and maps get you into trouble, right? So yes, it may seem like Ukraine holds only, let's say, some 24%, okay? But this 24% would take Russia a very long time to still fight through and take, right?
And
And
that is why during the peace negotiations, that's the reason I'm asking you, he's negotiating ask Ukrainians to withdraw from the entire Donetsk Oblast. If
yeah,
that's the
it's
case.
in terms of territory, it's as minimal territorial aim. It's very clear. It's a
Yeah.
priority for the Russian military and has been. There are lots of other areas where they could advance much easier than Donetsk if that's all they wanted to do. And I think it's clear there, from my point of view, there's two clear reasons why he's asking in negotiations for Ukraine to withdraw from Donetsk. First, because they haven't taken it. Like, if they could take it very easily, then it wouldn't be one of their principal negotiating demands, right? If it was so easy, then why have that be a demand? You could just say, well, I'm going to take Donetsk, right? But second, territory is to some extent an important indicator in a settlement, even if you didn't do well in the war. And Russia historically is very clear, will be seen as a loser of this war. Right, to me, it's very clear. There's been a fundamental mismatch between Russian political aims and military means throughout this war. But the negotiation of settlement is very important. I think the reason why he's demanding Ukraine withdraw from Donetsk is also political. Because if he can get this concession, then no matter the actual costs and the matter of the poor military performance, he can then still argue that he essentially compelled Ukraine and he can compel the West to give him Donetsk, right?
Donetsk Oblast,
That's
not
it.
just
That's it. Right.
Pity.
And to be clear, I personally don't think anybody in Russia cares about Donetsk. You would know better than me. I had, in the old days when you showed up.
Донецка до совет таймс.
Yeah, but like in all the, never, I've never heard anybody in my life actually in Russia care about much of any of these towns, these regions. So this is not, from my point of view, a deliverable to anybody in Russia. But I think for him, this is a way of showing in a settlement that Russia didn't lose the war. That's why, that's part of the reason why he's demanding it, that he forced it. But getting back to the manpower issue, so the challenge Russia is going to have is in 2025, the unrecoverable casualties were very close to the recruitment rate. And so they weren't able to expand the force any further. Unlike previous years, the Russian military kept growing in this war, kept growing in size. True, the Russian military right now is probably 40 to 50% larger in terms of personnel than it was in 2022 when the war began.
So is it truly 1.2 million people, as Putin claimed
Yeah.
that Russian army should reach 1.2 million people?
No, the goal he agreed to with Gerasimov was 1.5.
1.5.
1.5. It is probably close to 1.2.
So it's the biggest army except for China.
It's a good question. Maybe in terms of active service, mean, the force expanded quite a bit. I think they probably started this war with the smallest army Russia had had
Of course.
in contemporary history, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah.
And it probably grew, if you look at partial mobilization and then all the waves of contractors that they recruited to, yeah, maybe towards 1.2. And then we clearly see kind of the peak in 25, where now this force cannot grow and has issues with replacing its losses. Because at this point, they're taking so many casualties on the battlefield that recruitment is just struggling to keep up with the losses. Okay. And as they head into 2026, they actually head at the intersection, right, of these graphs where their losses for the amount of territory they're taking keep increasing, right? They increase visibly in 2025, but their recruitment rate isn't.
And the mean age of, soldiers and officers of the Russian army is about 40 year old.
I would say late 30s, but yeah,
Late
I
30s.
would say late 30s. Yeah.
So
And same.
there are no more any young people who are
Well,
ready
no.
to fight for money.
Well, okay. I wouldn't be but categorical about it, but most of the people you see taking this money are probably going to be people in their 30s and 40s. And that's like an average, okay? And so you're playing people that are older. And most of the folks who were young, who were killed, were the original contract army that went into Ukraine in 2022. And the better part of that force was lost over the course of 2022, like the young folks that you're referring to. And it was incredibly detrimental to the Russian military because junior officers are very important to a force. And once you lose junior officers, you can replace people. You can go contract new people, sure, and you can give them a couple of weeks of training. But this force is no longer able to conduct complex operations. It cannot do combined arms maneuver. It cannot do any of the things that the previous force could do. Ukraine has had the same issue too. The Ukrainian army is largely a mobilized army. And all the people who wanted to fight and are still outside the recruitment center who swelled the ranks in 2022 went into the force. By 2023, after the summer offensive, you had a force largely filled out with mobilized personnel and also in many cases led by mobilized personnel, with many new units created, and you have similar issues where it's very difficult to find good junior leaders with experience. And this is just the challenge of losses and reconstitution over the course of a war, where neither army looks remotely the way they did when the war began, right? If you knew the Russian military, you knew the Ukrainian military in 2022, today you would see very different forces. On equipment depletion, I think, is no longer a useful metric. Russian equipment use went down so significantly in 2025 that it's not really connected to their ability to advance in this war, meaning they are still conducting armored assaults and mechanized attacks here and there, but they are fighting almost exclusively without traditional mechanized equipment. Or let's put it this way, their rate of advance is no longer tied to this, and their loss rate is really low compared to previous years. They lost a lot of equipment in this war, and this war consumed now most of what they had in storage and they inherited from the Soviet Union. In many ways, this is the last war of the Soviet army because it's largely being fought with Soviet equipment by the Russian military, and the Soviet equipment refilled the Russian force. And in general, you see that Even though equipment's not being lost that much now, this war consumed a lot of Russia's mobilization potential that it inherited from the Soviet Union. And new production of equipment is also going up, but at much lower rates. I would say throughout the war, if you look at Russian replacement, newly produced equipment was maybe 15% of that, and or 20 max in some cases, but most of this came, a lot of this came out of storage. But so to me, the whole Russia's running out of equipment thing is no longer relevant in 2025 because you don't see equipment being all that relevant to the fight. Russian forces continue to underperform relative to their advantage. And you see that they make plans at higher level commands, but the force just can't execute tactically, right? And so, and they also have an issue where they constantly claim tactical successes to military leadership, but it didn't happen. Like the war becomes increasingly cynical. By this point in the war is deeply cynical. And you see a lot of falsification, and you see a lot of challenges in Russia's ability to conduct operations because there's a lot of internal falsification of data, right? And so the system's lying to itself quite a bit at tactical levels. Okay. So if we look at maybe just numbers, and not always that useful, but just to kind of show you, we'll get off this map for a second. Jeez. So this is my colleagues from Blackbird Group. It's a Finnish OSINT organization. I know them quite well, and I'm borrowing this graph from them. Look, last year, Russia gained more territory, just pure numbers, than 2024. Okay? It depends on whether you include just Ukrainian territory or also the fight for Kursk. But that increase isn't that significant, to be honest. Without Kursk, it was maybe 30% more. But at substantially increased losses, right?
And let's tell us, so people know Kursk is the part of is the Russian Federation Kursk region, which was occupied by Ukrainian forces.
Yeah. If you include Kursk, and the reason I do is because we're interested in like battlefield advance versus just Ukrainian territory taken. These are slightly two different interrelated questions. If you include Kursk, then actually Russia took maybe 16% more territory overall that was able to seize through offensive operation this year than last year. And so in general, the results are, to me, ones largely of operational failure, and combat efficiency went down somewhat, meaning the casualties and the losses for the amount of territory they took increased. All right. On the Ukrainian side, so Ukraine's biggest problem remains manpower. I think everybody knows about it at this point if you follow the war. It's clear that it's going very difficult to solve. I think Ukraine still has the ability to stabilize the manning situation so that the force doesn't deplete. The biggest issue I see that everybody talks about in amongst Ukrainian leadership is the AWOL problem, those who are absent without leave, says the chair. This is a big issue in that of those who are mobilized, right? A notable percentage of those people do not make it from training into the actual force. And what ends up happening is that the effective combat strength of the Ukrainian military as deployed last year had been slowly shrinking, meaning the numbers they are getting are not quite sufficient to maintain the force. And the drone force that they expanded is expanding, but it's expanding significantly by recruiting from within the military, not recruiting people outside of it. Okay. And that's a force that starts to cannibalize itself because if I go to this infantry unit and start recruiting from them for my drone unit, what's this infantry unit going to be fighting with, right? And so the challenge you get is that there's very few people available for infantry. That's why you have such low manning. There's not enough units available for rotations. And the big issue Ukraine has is a real lack of operational reserve. And that's led the military now for a while to practice a firefighting approach. And what that means is that when Russian forces are advancing on one part of the front, Ukraine's best units, Ukraine's assault units, better drone units, airborne troops are sent to this part of the front to stabilize it. And while they stabilize it, two other parts of the front light on fire, okay, and become a problem because there's no reserves for them. Those units there do not have any forces providing them a reserve. So, for an example, if you saw Ukraine counterattack at Pokrovsk-Mirnograd to try to hold on to it in the fall because they didn't want particularly the political fallout in the midst of negotiations here while they are making the case that they're holding on to Donetsk. Nobody wanted to open up a headline from New York Times saying Pokrovsk falls, something, something, Russian troops take Pokrovsk. Okay, we can understand like sometimes it's about the tactical significance of something and sometimes it's about the much broader political significance that any battle might have when you're in the midst of negotiations. But while you do that, there's nobody available for Dnipropetrovsk-Zaporizhia. And so you see Russians quickly advance on Huliapolia. And you see by the end of the year, Siversk, also north of Slavyansk. I won't say abandoned, but essentially Ukrainian forces withdraw. Not much of a battle there. So this is a common problem where the lack of reserves make it such that if Ukrainian forces are focused on one battle, there's just not enough to go around to stabilize other parts of the front. And the big issue is that prepared defenses really are not as defining anymore as they were before, partly because they're not manned and they're used to canalize advances, but most of this is zone defense with drones at this point, rather than traditional manned defense. So a lot of the observable defensive lines are less useful for us to kind of use as a guide for how the fighting will go. The reason I say this is, look, Donetsk is politically very important. I'm very skeptical of the Fortress Donetsk line, and I'll tell you why. Like, this made sense, from 2014 up to maybe 2024. The reason why Donetsk remains useful is because Russian forces are so focused on taking it. And in this war, defensive lines are anchored in towns and cities. And Donetsk is key terrain not because there are some magical fortifications there, okay? Or not because that's the one place where trenches are manned. Right? It's not the case. Or that's like some high terrain. Like Donetsk is not the Golan Heights, okay? I'm sorry. I'm there every 3 months. That's not what it looks like. All right. So it's not like some key strategic terrain where if you just took Donetsk, then you had all access to all these other things. What makes Donetsk significant, beyond the fact that politically it's important and people have been fighting over it for so many years, is how urban it is, okay? And the fact that it's much easier to tie down Russian forces because of the number of cities available and the ability to anchor defense there, okay? And even that, to me, increasingly is a difficult argument to make given how tactically the war had changed. So it's a relevant piece of terrain, but I'm not sold on the, if Russian forces take Donetsk, then somehow all of the rest of Ukraine is now vulnerable because Donetsk occupies a special place or is specially fortified in a way that nothing else can be fortified. I hope this makes sense. Okay.
So I'm sorry, let me clarify this so I understand this better. So you say that the whole point for Ukrainians to fight for Donbas, for Donetsk Oblast, is to tie Russian forces there so Putin won't have forces to occupy Zaporozhye or the Kherson as a city, they control Kherson Oblast, but they don't control Kherson or Kharkiv. Is that, do I understand it right?
So first, Ukrainian forces basically fight for every piece of terrain. In Ukraine, to withdraw from any position, you need higher approval. So it's very hard to conduct a maneuver mobile defense. And the policy is to fight for every piece of terrain, especially cities. The main reason I think folks fight for Donetsk is first, Donetsk remains politically important and symbolic, and because Putin wants it so much. Okay. Right. Second, Donetsk is much more urban than other areas. And so if Russia is focused on taking it, this is the hardest fight for them.
This is city Donetsk,
And this is the
and this
oblast.
is the oblast,
Yes.
the region.
Yes.
And Russian forces were trying, to control part of Zaporozhye. They're very close to Kharkiv because Kharkiv is just 40 kilometers from the border with Russia. And they're trying, there was an attempt to, as far as I understand, to take control over Kharkiv as well, right?
Yeah, it was a failed summer offensive in
Yes.
24. It was more attempt to kind of advance on both sides of
And also
Kharkiv.
Dnipropetrov,
Okay, about
right?
this, yeah. So, usually, the Russian military is not in a position to take any of these large cities, whether it's Zaporizhia or Dnipro or Kharkiv. But as a matter of talk about, the danger is that over the course of last year, while they were tied down in Donetsk, they advanced quite a bit here, okay? And so the challenge Ukraine has increased from going to 2026 is if they focus and concentrate on defense of Donetsk, the dilemma is it will come at increasing Russian gains in Dnipro and Zaporizhia. And Dnipro and Zaporizhia are economically very important, okay? First of all, just in terms of people, economy, These are still vibrant areas. And in terms of industry, this is still where a lot of Ukrainian industry actually is. And Russian forces are not that far from Zaporizhia here. They are quite a ways from Dnipro, but
How many kilometers from here to here, or miles, whatever?
it depends because Zaporizhia is a very big city. So if you're counting the outskirts of the city versus the middle of it, but you're looking at a lot of these places, maybe 30, 30 plus km. It's not that far. They
So
were.
4 to 5 miles, right? Or 50 miles.
No,
Oh, by the way, I'm sorry, go
actually
ahead.
shorter, actually shorter. So increasingly, if you get closer, then you can start reaching the outskirts of the city with drones. If you look at Dnipro and Pavlograd, so Russian forces here are about 75 kilometers from Pavlograd. It's still quite a substantial distance, but you see the challenge that basically, if you just play this out for another year, the challenge increasingly that Ukraine faces is you can focus on tying down any Russian advance in Donetsk, but it's hard to have forces for this and also all this and also parts of this, although they've done quite well holding the Russian military here along the Oskil River. Briefly, a bit on the strike campaign. So both sides spent 25 trying to suppress each other's defense industrial production. Half of Russian strikes for much of the year were focused on Ukraine's defense industry until the fall, when they switched many of the strikes towards energy infrastructure, and the focus of their strikes are power generation, especially gas, which in Ukraine is important for home heating. Like many of the cities use centralized heating using gas. And also trying to fragment Ukraine's electricity grid. So a lot of Russian strikes are kind of near-term focused to maximize pain in Ukraine, but also because this winter is much colder than the last two winters, Ukraine faces much harder conditions this year around than the last two. The last two winters were unseasonably warm in Europe in general. Like you go usually every February. And so I'm just telling you some for some experience. It was very warm in February, Ukraine last year, and I don't think it's going to be very warm this February. And you see that because of that, you have major power outages in big cities. You have a lot of people with no electricity, no hot water in some cases for days now, and consistent outages. It's a big problem for the civilian population. It's also a problem for defense industrial production, so you understand, because what do you need? What does the defense industry need? Electricity. Okay, nothing gets made without electricity. So if you don't have electricity and a city doesn't have electricity, okay, they might have a generator, but they're not going to have a generator that kind of lasts forever, right? So that's an issue too. So electricity is important all around. And electricity affects production because Ukraine makes a lot of the drones and munitions it needs for the day-to-day fight. So it's a factor not just for the civilian population, for the defense industry. Ukraine strikes are much more medium term. They are oriented towards the Russian state's ability to earn income from energy exports. They're designed to cause internal disruption of not just fuel supply, but also the ability of Russian state to sustain the war economically. So they're hitting key production nodes, not just in defense industry, but in Russia's energy export infrastructure. And the idea basically being that, okay, if you combine the stagnating Russian economy, low oil prices right now, right? Sanctions that were passed last year and increasing problems that Russia's facing with the shadow fleet, the actual physical shipment of oil, it has to offer it at substantial discounts. This is not something that's going to affect Russia's ability to conduct this war in the short term, like 3 months, 4 months, 5 months. But the thinking is later into 2026, this will be a growing factor, right? And eventually, like, yes, the war likely hit any diminishing returns for Russia from my point of view. If not at the failure of the opening invasion, okay, then definitely by late 2024. Wars often go on long beyond a point when either side can attain a decisive advantage, and they often continue even during negotiations. But even if you might think Putin is completely unreasonable, you cannot argue that he's totally immune to all costs, or maybe you will. But basically, to me, this is a fairly sound theory of steady economic strangulation of Russia's ability to sustain this war as its battlefield gains steadily diminish in terms of what Russia's able to gain relative to the cost it's paying for it. And you've probably seen late last year also in the Black Sea, there's been an expanding strike campaign against Russia shadow fleets and Russian strikes against Ukrainian ports. So there was a collapse of what was an earlier understanding between the two sides. going back to late 2023, not to go after commercial shipping. And now we're seeing much more unrestricted naval warfare against commercial shipping. And I'll pay close attention to this. It's not just in the Black Sea. It's also been in the Mediterranean and other places. I was happy I was going to talk a little bit how it's evolving to 2026, but I apologize. I probably went on too long already. I think people likely have questions. Maybe we should do a Q&A. And then
Talk a
I'll.
little bit about casualties because you know there are recent reports suggest that by now Russians' unrecoverable losses are about 1.2 million people and Ukrainian about 800,000 people. What do you think? You know,
Total casualties, not recoverable
okay.
losses. Total casualties.
Total
But
casualties,
total casualties
killed,
are
wounded, and you
killed,
know.
wounded, missing in action.
Missing
Okay.
it.
But total casualties are, sorry, not to be kind of like pedantic about this, but I'm going to be pedantic about this. Okay. So we're in an academic space. Okay. Why not? You know, like, what's the point of coming to a university and then not argue over a narcissism of small differences, right? So let's do it. Total casualties are not a useful number because it's a number that easily balloons out, and it's not useful to compare either because different countries, different militaries count casualties differently. To me, those are potentially fair numbers, but to me, unrecoverable losses, which are very high, those killed and seriously injured, are the ones that really matter because those people are not lightly wounded. And they will not be able to return to military service. And they will also face a very difficult time trying to be productive in the economy. So there, probably you're looking on the Russian side, not 1.2 million, but still a very large number.
Over 1 million or less than 1 million.
I would be a liar if I said for sure. And just so you'll know, casualties are always presented as a range, not as an exact number. Okay. Okay. Because the Russian state itself doesn't know, okay, just to be clear, the exact number. And it's always a range. So what's useful to say is, let's say somewhere in the 800K to million range for that, okay? It's actually, look, sometimes it's better not to offer false precision on things, which you get a lot in newspaper articles, and it's less precise than that, but the range is useful for us to understand what we're dealing with. For Russia killed in action, I think a fair range might be, 350 to 450,000, which is a lot. If you don't, this is more killed in action than first Russia or the Soviet Union had in any war post-World War II combined, all those conflicts put together. And it's more killed in action. Not than, let's say, any conventional war. If I was to show you 8 years of Iran-Iraq war, you'd find a lot of casualties there too. But comparatively speaking, for a large power of any kind, it's very hard to find wars where another country has lost this amount of killed in action. China had a lot of killed in action for its, during its participation in the Korean War, still probably visibly less than this amount. And so these are very, very high casualty numbers, right? These are casualty numbers that start taking us back to much larger conventional wars. And, I think that, again, for Russia, I'm not sure what else to add to on casualties. For Ukraine, I try not to speak specifically to Ukrainian casualties, but I would
What's the
say,
range? Still, what's the range?
So I'm just going to venture a guess, okay, that probably you'll see a different structure of casualties in that Ukraine has a lot more wounded relative to those killed within the ratio, whereas Russia has a lot more killed and seriously injured. The reason for that is several fold. First, Russia's been the side conducting offensive operations for most of the war, and the attacking side bears the larger burden of casualties, much larger burden of casualties. Second, the attacking side has a much larger of unrecoverable casualties because it can't recover them from the battlefield. Third, Russian battlefield medicine was shown to be quite poor. And fourth, Russian military has been fighting with an assault layer of expendable personnel. They defrayed a percentage of the cost initially of the casualties, on to mobilized personnel from LDNR, the mobilized Luhansk, Donetsk, so-called People's Republics, and also a significant number onto convicts, which they used in assault units. A very sizable number, actually. And so if you look at the way they've been using their people, they generally haven't cared nearly as much about actually recovering these battlefield casualties. So
Putting their lips up, you know.
they're killed in actions much higher. And so on the Ukrainian side, you have far fewer killed, but you have a lot more wounded, right? Different kinds. So, the number you gave, 1.2, came from this recent CSIS publication. And CSIS put out a ratio, I think, there of 2.5 to 1 of sort of Russian personnel killed or seriously injured to Ukrainian one, with some differences in the composition of casualties. I think that's a reasonable ratio of like 2.5 to 1, maybe 3 to
So
1
about 600,000.
on what, the Ukrainian side?
Ukraine, yeah.
So I think killed and seriously injured on the Ukrainian side is probably lower than that. I think that's a high number. But it's a sizable amount, but it's a fairly sizable amount. Couple things. You should keep in mind that the population asymmetry is significant. Russia is five times the population of Ukraine. Right? And it's got, in some cases, you might think it has more reserves, but what's interesting is that both sides are actually struggling with this manpower equation. Russia on paper has more people, but doesn't have great access to them because Russia functionally has almost no unemployment and a huge deficit of skilled labor as an economy. So it's a very tight labor market that actually is very short on people, on labor. So even though on Excel spreadsheet, Russia has way more people, since it is not mobilizing people anymore, the state has to pay for them. And if you have functional with no unemployment, you have to pay a huge amount of money to get these people. Okay?
And unemployment is 2.5% in Russia.
Yeah, that's
It's none,
functionally.
non-existent.
That's what I said. That's what, it's not zero, but it's functionally so low that it's a very low number. Right? And on the Ukrainian side, you have partial mobilization and you have volunteer recruitment contracting, but volunteer recruitment contracting really doesn't keep up with the military's needs. So you have waves of partial mobilization. Okay, so the bottom line is, in absolute numbers, Ukraine has clearly significantly fewer casualties than Russia. That is true. In relative numbers, Russia has more casualties than Ukraine does. That is also true. But Ukrainian casualties are still quite significant and is a challenge. But as I said in the earlier part of this discussion, an equally big challenge for Ukraine is just the absent without leave problem. Because it saps a lot of their ability to mobilize people and replace losses in the force. And that's why they're so focused publicly in discussing and tackling it.
Talking about weapons, you already, touched on this subject, but still, I would like, a little bit more details on that. So back in 2023 and again in 2024, a lot of experts predicted that Putin would run out of weapons. At some point, yeah, there were reports that, for instance, Sasha Goitz, and some others. Okay.
All right, Sasha's an old friend. Please don't put me in a position
I'm not
to
going
have
to take that part of
to,
that. He worked for me. So, at some point, the Russian army used tanks, T-54, meaning produced in 1954, and rifles made in 1948. These stockpiles of Russian weapons. There were also predictions. I read a lot of analysis that that Putin was to run out of Soviet weaponry by mid-summer of 2025. There were reports that Russian missiles production was running out of chips because the Russians failed to build their own production facilities, and 5 billion rubles assigned to production were all stolen. However, we see that Putin has gotten enough missiles, not talking about drones, they converted a lot of, enterprises markets just to produce drones, and civilian enterprises just to produce drones, but missiles. And so that it allows him to bomb Ukrainian cities every single night. Where is Putin getting his missiles from?
Okay, sure. So I don't know how we got down the path of kind of Russia and run out of equipment, but all I'll say is that Russia had very large equipment losses during the course of this war. They online a very substantial capacity to repair and refurbish equipment taken out of storage. New production was, like I said, a very small percentage of anything that they actually employed. They are at this point, not, I will say, empty, but they've used up a lot of serviceable equipment that was available in storage to fill the force. Not all this equipment was lost either. As I said, the force expanded considerably. If you remember, in September of 2022, partial mobilization yielded 300,000 personnel. They used a large part of that to build out a reserve, a bunch of reserve units. That's where the T-55 tanks went, for example. Russia's not running equipment. A bigger than for that, and why we get into this issue, and I'm happy to explain this because analytically, so you appreciate. Wars go through phases, right? And so you're always challenged in that it's very hard to forecast in the future because you're extrapolating based on the past. So how the fighting went last year and what was important last year and the numbers you're working with, you're using that to make judgments for the next year. So from the first year of the war, what was really important is the correlation of artillery fire, and this was decisive, right? And then later we were looking not just at artillery fires, but availability of equipment on the Russian side because they were conducting mechanized attacks. This analytically makes sense. But then we enter a different phase in the war, the battlefield dynamic changes, and then you see drones making it much more difficult to use mechanized equipment. The Russian military eventually seeing that's just losing a lot of equipment, not gaining much for it, and abandoning the extensive use of mechanized equipment, instead trading losses of equipment for losses of people,
Right,
which
okay, but
actually, yeah.
we're talking about chips now. I understand
Hold
that
on.
Russians managed
Yeah.
to employ North Koreans to produce a lot of shells and all this, simple, iron. But what about chips? How,
So,
even in Bulava, that they were
yeah.
using American chips in, those, Russian missiles. They were buying, stealing or buying chips from Americans. How do they do that? Is it all Chinese or what?
Yeah, so Russian missile production in many categories increased 3 times over what it was in 2022, and in some categories more than 3 times. And I'll tell you why. First, despite claims I heard in early 2022, they were able to substantially expand defense industrial production by having access to a large number of components and the things they needed from China and through China and other countries. A series of countries, particularly in Central Asia and other places, became major importers and exporters of Western technology. I don't have these graphs because I didn't bring them because I didn't know you were going to ask this, but you could suddenly. As the war begins, you can suddenly see countries in Central Asia
Kazakhstan and
increase their imports
Kyrgyzstan,
of German industrial goods by more than tenfold. And you have to believe one of two things. Either suddenly in these countries, there's this booming need for Western industrial production, 10 times what it was before in the course of a year, or they are reselling it to Russia. These are the two logical explanations, and you're welcome to believe which one you think is true.
we know which one is true because we're
If you're
investigating
going to
things.
go there and believe that they are now industrial paradises employing all these goods, maybe. But I suspect the second explanation is the likely one, right? Russia has, first of all, chips are much harder to, like general chips are much harder to contain than people think they are. What sanctions and export controls do is they slow down acquisition and they make it more costly. But for defense industrial applications, for many of them, if the country wants to spend more money, they'll get access to them. Where it's easiest to constrain is for very narrow applications where you need a very specific technology that's only made by a specific company in a specific place. And there, I'll give you an example. Even before this war, one area where we were very good at denying Russia access were certain types of chips for space-based applications for satellites because they were so narrow and so specialized. But general chips and technologies, a lot of military technology is very much commercial technology. And when I hear people saying, like, well, why can't we contain the sale of these chips? There's like saying people, why can't we contain the spread of the wheel? This is a base industrial technology, like industrial era technology. It's very hard to contain. Okay. So it needs to be ideally more narrow-based applications. There are things that Russia gets that we can certainly export control. We haven't done a good job about that. Lots of sanctions and export controls got passed. This is the easiest part. What most people don't realize is none of this works without enforcement. And enforcement's the part that matters, not the, oh, we passed these sanctions and here are these sanctions on this paper. Okay? So without a real organized plan of enforcement of these export controls and these sanctions, these are things that happen, but it's actually much harder. It's much harder to achieve these effects on Russian defense industry. And lastly, it's not easy to do when one of the major global economies and industrial powerhouse in the world is China, and it is supplying Russia, and actually allows Russia to continue this war, not just by providing key materials, precursors, and various other goods, but simply the Chinese economy was there for Russia to import the things that it suddenly needed at the start of this war, right? So Chinese cars flooded the Russian market, right? Russia started importing a lot of
48%
things.
of the Russian
Yeah,
market.
it started importing a lot of things it suddenly couldn't make. Yeah, sanctions killed aspects of Russia's industry, and they just bought those things from China because the Chinese economy was there available with these goods to provide. And without that, Russia, I mean, honestly, without China, I don't see how Russia will sustain this war at all into 2026. And lastly, both Russian and Ukrainian development of drones and electronic warfare systems is very largely based on Chinese components. Okay, so China actually supplied components to both sides. They're like the Lego blocks from which they built these things. And without them, you would never see the same rapid evolution of drones and electronic warfare and other types of systems. It is primarily done with Chinese components and Chinese ships and Chinese modules and Chinese circuitry. And China also had strong dominance of the commercial drone market. And so for a long time, both Russia and Ukraine, especially Russia, are heavily dependent on it. And Russia had specialized access that Ukraine didn't. I won't get into like the nitty-gritty details of this, but Russia's advantage access to this.
Got it. Did I get you right that neither side, neither Russia, nor Ukraine, nor Putin, nor Ukraine can win this war? When
No.
President Trump says that President Zelensky doesn't have cards, I assume that he means that Putin is going to win this war, right? And what is your take? Can Putin win the war?
Okay. This is a different question. So first, I'm going to tell you what I think Trump's saying. I can, but I just don't think that's like a very interesting discussion.
All right.
Listen, I live in Washington, D.C. area, so I live very close to the reactor. And like, I don't, my dream of coming to New York City is to not immediately begin to talk about what Trump meant, what he said. Okay. I've only been here like an hour and a half, so give me that.
Who's going to win this war?
Let's talk about your other questions, which is the easier question. So first, just my own view. You're not gonna like this answer, I think. But first, what do we mean by winning? How do we define winning when we say win the war? If we look at a couple things. First, Russia's political aims in this war, how it started this war, the initial invasion to install a pro-Russian regime in Kiev to occupy most of Ukraine. It's clear that not only this operation failed, but Russia has no prospect of achieving these war aims
Right, but
and
you
hasn't
asked
had
the
a failure.
question how Putin is going to sell this to his pub, to
Well,
his elite.
let's not change questions because the question you asked is very interesting and I want to stay with it. All right. Okay. So it's clear they can't achieve these aims, right? If you periodize this war, not in military phases, but like a big picture strategic periodization, you're kind of looking at two wars. There's the first 30 days, which is the Russian coup de main attempt to install a pro-Russian regime in Ukraine that fails, okay? And then there's the rest of the war. And the rest of the war already is clearly not about whether Ukraine will be an independent sovereign state or remain an independent a nation with its own national identity. That question is almost clearly settled in the first 30 days, and Russia fails in this invasion. The rest of the war is what will be the borders of the state. Will the state be economically viable, right? Like, what will be the losses, the consequences of this war on Ukraine? And will Ukraine still retain the options of Western integrations or not? Will some peace be imposed upon it that will deny it kind of a Western path? These are the questions really being decided at this point in this war. And I guess also who controls Donetsk, but I'm sure you understand that most of Ukraine doesn't live in the last 25% of Donetsk, okay? Like, that's very clear. This is important, but I've said this many times. Whatever happens in 2026, the war will not be decided by who controls the next 20 kilometers of this front line. I can zoom out and show you this front, and maybe Russia advances 20% faster or 20% slower. It will not be deterministic of the outcome of this war. I hope this part makes sense. And this war is not about Donetsk. Putin may try to explain later those about Donetsk, but it's not what this war is about. And he demands national level concessions from Ukraine, and that's not how this war began. Okay, so don't let people tell you that this war is just about territory in Donetsk. Right, so even on the if we look at minimal war aims, because countries have just a range of war aims from minimal to maximum. I'm increasingly skeptical that Russia will be able to achieve them, and nobody historically, I think, will judge that the costs were worth it. I think this will be seen historically as a defeat for Russia and a strategic failure, even though the story is not yet written. Right? It's going to be very hard to sell. Okay. Let's talk about the Ukrainian side of the equation. This is harder. It's also clear Ukraine won't achieve its maximalist goals of restoring territorial control. The dream that was there in 2022, especially after the Kharkiv and Kherson offensives, where people thought maybe actually you could push the Russian forces at least back to February 22, July. I remember I was in Kherson in October 2022, and the feeling, kind of the general vibe, was maybe it's possible. Okay. And maybe back then it was illusory and all this fine, but you could understand that the momentum was on the Ukrainian side, and Russia was struggling with a structural deficit of manpower, and things were really bad for Russia in September, October 2022. Okay, so maximum war aims may not be achieved, but there is a good chance that Ukraine comes out of this, right, as a sovereign independent state, right, with a distinct national identity. Yes, it will be dependent on the West economically for a long time, but likely economically viable because it still has Odessa. It still has a lot of industry. Like, it has commercial access. And if you look at all the worst case scenarios of February 22 potentially for Ukraine, those will not come to pass. Okay. Will history judge this as a victory for Ukraine? I don't know. Okay. I think it's important to understand that expectations really shifted in 2022 into believing that, okay, maximalist war aims were possible. But if we go back to how this war began, to me, already this is to some extent the success story, although understanding that the cost that Ukraine will pay, the loss of population, the loss of territory is very significant. All right, the last part, here's the part you won't like. We don't know who wins the war. We don't know how it ends necessarily when it ends, because this requires a historical perspective, and I'll tell you why. It really helps to have some time from the war to look back on how it ended to then judge in context what happened. Because let's say a ceasefire is made, a settlement is made tomorrow. Okay. And let's say Ukraine gets real security guarantees. And let's say Russia does not launch a third continuation war to that. And Ukraine gets significant economic reinvestment. Europeans do decide to actually use Russian funds instead of using German funds and calling them Eurobonds. I personally don't care because it's all the same to me, but I'm just saying, like, let's say this money is made available for Ukraine. That's one future. Let's say a ceasefire settlement is made, Ukraine has to withdraw from Donetsk, and within a year, Russia launches a third war, okay, and takes even more territory. All right. You have different judgments on how this war ended based on what happened afterwards, right? We need some time from the ending of a war to be able to look back on it to really know what happened. Was there a peace that ended the war? How do we know the day it's made? How do we know that the peace was worth the piece of paper it was signed? And I'll give you the many cases like this. In the Korean War, the initial US reflection on the Korean War was that we did poorly. We saw it almost as a defeat. And then many years later, when we reflect on the Korean War, we actually saw that we did much better in the Korean War than we thought. Actually, Korean War today is seen very differently historically than it was back then when it ended. And so the reason I give you this answer, and I say you're not going to like it, and I'm not trying to dodge your answer, right, is answering who won and who lost is not an easy kind of the answer is 42, okay? I think Ukraine ultimately ends up doing much better in this war than expected. I certainly expected initially by analysts like myself who were predicting the war would happen, but thought the initial conventional phase of the war was not going to go well for Ukraine. And I think it certainly does better than Russia. I think this war, and I'm sure you'll probably agree on this, I think this war will set Russia back for a very long time. The consequences
Absolutely.
of this war for Russia will be very significant. And to me, this is going to be a calamitous war for Russia. From an economic perspective, from a demographic perspective, coming just out of COVID, Russia had high excess mortality. Fatalities, sorry, excess mortalities due to COVID. Then you get into this war and it loses a lot more people, and a whole bunch of people also leave Russia as well. So the consequence for Russia, I think will be quite dark. Sorry, it's a very hard answer. Like, how do we know who's
Good.
this? Yeah.
Michael, good. In peace negotiations, President Zelensky has recently slightly changed his language. He no longer talks about security guarantees, so we assume that, he got some assurances about those security guarantees, but insists that the issue of the occupied territories of Ukraine, which account of 20%, is still not resolved. There are several questions I would like to ask you. One, what kind of security guarantees to Ukraine do you consider necessary? We have, the case of South Korea, when it wasn't just security guarantees, but also nuclear weapons put in South Korea as a deterrence. And we have the case of Cyprus, when, basically Greek and Turks, parts of Cyprus exist, more or less peacefully, and no one is capable to win. So what are security guarantees we're talking about?
Okay, so I think security guarantees for Ukraine is become a term of political art, and it's a package of a couple different things. One, it's a series of financial commitments to maintain the Ukrainian military.
Okay.
Okay, right. Second, it is a series of commitments to continue arming Ukraine. Third, there's a both a European force that will serve as some kind of security assistance force or guarantor that's been put together by British and French, which will have a land component, quite likely, I think, in Western Ukraine, but also an air component in other parts that is being considered as part of this deal, but also a separate security guarantee they're looking to get from the United States that will ideally be more than just an executive agreement by Trump. And the big question is, what will this guarantee from the United States be separately from what Europeans are offering? And what will that commitment offer? Because here's the bottom commitment. States are not going to lock themselves into specific military action on behalf of another state. Even those of you who are familiar with NATO, if you read Article 5 of NATO, what it says is states are obligated to individually and collectively, right, provide support and military aid to the attack party. It doesn't say what they actually have to do and that they have to fight on their behalf, right? It leaves that kind of open, what you end up doing. And so even if you see what's being discussed now for the United States, an Article 5 style guarantee, you have to keep in mind that Article 5 doesn't say that much in it, in the case of NATO. And so this guarantee is probably going to be, a balance between something that's robust but flexible enough for the United States to actually make it. Okay. What else can I add? To me, all these things are important for Ukraine. Lastly, people are trying to get some kind of ceasefire monitoring force component in there as well and try to tie the United States to that. I'm not sure that that's necessary. That's something we're going to do. And I don't know what's being debated right now. I don't know if there's going to be any U.S. boots on the ground. This Trump administration seems reticent, but they've shifted positions on this, like, back and forth. So,
Occupied territories. So, would you expect the Ukrainian military and security forces to accept the deal, which will require the Ukrainian army to give up on Donbas and accept a frozen conflict along the current front line?
If there's a national referendum, which I suspect is how Zelensky will try to do it, because I'm deeply skeptical that he will sign that deal. I think the only two options stand before him are the easy option, which is not clear how it will be accepted, which is to get the Ukrainian Rada to vote for it. And I don't know how easy that option is. Sorry, I refer to it as the easy option relative to the other option, which is national referendum. But will it accept it? I don't have a good answer for it. Like, I don't speak for the Ukrainian military, and I don't know what
People
one
like
person.
Budanov, will they accept? The head of the Ukrainian intelligence won,
Yeah, who's
and now
now
he's
he's now in
the
Yermak's position, right?
yes, now he's the head of the office of the president.
Well, look, Ukraine at the end of the day is a democratic country, so if this is the president's position and there's a national referendum on it, they kind of have to. This
What's your expectation about the outcomes of the national referendum?
I don't know. It's a very good question. The challenge that I see is that Ukrainian public in general has long wanted the war to end, and everybody does, and would like to see a ceasefire, but not at any price. Okay. And where I was going to get towards the end of this talk was that currently, look, everybody's exhausted. The military is exhausted too. But Ukraine's position, military position, is not that fragile. Ukraine ended 2025 in some ways actually a bit better than the end of 2024. It's not a rosy picture, but look, Russia did not achieve any of the major operational objectives. But Ukraine is not in a position that it has to accept a deal, any deal, or is desperate for a ceasefire right now. Okay, that's the reality. And I don't see anything in the coming months that's going to put it in that position either. So what happened last year is there was a narrowing of positions. And this was driven in very much by the Trump administration's efforts to try to get a deal, as clumsy as they were and completely lacking in process and thought as they were. Nonetheless, they were a catalyst to force a narrowing of positions. Ukraine had to really narrow its position for what it would accept, much closer to its actual military performance. Europeans also had a real narrowing of positions, especially in the fall. I know you're going to guess who I think has not narrowed their position at all relative to their actual military performance, and is trying to negotiate on the basis of aspirational military successes, but not actually what they achieved on the battlefield. And that's Moscow, right? And so the challenge I see increasing is actually not on the Ukrainian side. It's now much more on the Russian side. The Russians are stalling, and they continue to tell themselves that if we just fight a little bit more, there'll be this collapse of Ukraine front line. But the reality is that they have the biggest mismatch right now between their political demands and like their military means.
Okay, Dunbar doctrine. Do you believe, that Putin and Trump, they made a deal that Trump control, gets control over Venezuela, which was a Russia Putin's ally, and in exchange, Trump will close his eyes on Putin's control over Ukraine. Do you believe there was this deal,
No,
or
not at
no,
all.
not at
Oh,
all?
did you get the Nutshell Crisscross movie? I mean, what is this? No, not at all. This is crazy.
Last question.
Sorry, this is Reddit. This is like Reddit
You're on
level.
a
No,
history
I know
course.
you don't believe this. I don't throw this at me. I know.
You
What other
find
conspiracy
interesting.
theories would you like me to rotate for you?
The same here on my side. Last question. There are two schools of thought regarding Putin's incentives. One suggests, quote, a ceasefire in Ukraine merely allows Russia to replenish its stockpiles of weapons and to deploy and train troops. Any real peace on our continent, meaning Europe, will require regime change in Russia and an end to its aggressive politics. End of quote. Another school of thought claims that Putin's war economy put him in a corner. He's desperate to get a break and end this war. Putin lost his footprint in Syria. He's about to lose it in Iran. He lost his ally in Venezuela. He's getting weak. Russia as a power is getting really weak on the global stage. What is your take on that?
Okay. I don't really like either school of thoughts, to be honest. They both have some truth, but analytically, I don't find either of those positions attractive. So, on regime change and all this, yes, it would be nice, but like Russia is not a country populated by one person who sits at this control center, which is buttons and dials. It is a country with a sizable population, so you have both a Putin and a Russia problem. And then the people who will follow him will come from that strategic community and that elite. They're not going to be imported from some
Oh,
other elite.
they're
Sorry.
going to be KGB guys,
Yeah,
yes.
sorry. Like, I know you know this very well. Like, where do you think these people will come from? And so I don't believe in the fanciful solutions that, okay, we just replace the leader, we do regime change, and all the problems are solved. People do matter. Leaders' ideas matter. For example, Putin personally really cares about Ukraine, is sentimental about Ukraine in the way that Russian elites and others are not. That's true. But we should not reduce everything in Russia to just the person in charge, even though there's a personal style of authoritarianship. Okay. So I do think there are like structural problems with Russia, and there are also structural problems that we have to deal with related to the collapse of the Soviet Union. To me, this is a still kind of a fallout of the collapse of the Soviet Union, which was an event but a process. This is the continued aftershock of the collapse of the Soviet Union, and this is principally a war of Soviet succession. And those of us who kind of made it through the 90s and 2000 thought the Soviet Union collapsed, there were a bunch of smaller wars, we contained nuclear proliferation and all that, and it seemed like this state collapsed rather peacefully. But the truth is that it's not over, right? And it's actually that process still playing itself out historically. Okay. On the whole, like Russia, Russia's a declining power. It was a, I mean, you could say that there was a period of resurgence.
Prompt Putin to stop the war? That's the only question I'm interested
Just be clear. Just be clear. No, I'll tell you why. First, sorry. No. Can I tell you something? If your version of Putin was a reasonable person who would have won, not started this war, two, ended it 30 days after the entire invasion failed, okay? And three, we would not be in the fifth year of this war. You started out by saying
Collective
this war has
Putin.
lasted longer for Russia than the Great Patriotic War. This seemed like a reasonable person with a solid assessment of costs relative to gains. And so now he will stop this war. No, so this general, the way you described this kind of weakening of Russian global position is not that relevant to the core interests in Ukraine. Second, I think the real challenge for him will be economic condition, the economic condition, the macroeconomic situation of Russia. And over time, that'll be a growing factor. He's even not even that interested in battlefield performance because for whatever reason, he's convinced that slowly Russia's winning. Even though what's actually happening is slowly they are taking territory, but slowly taking its territory does not actually bring Russia closer to achieving the demands they have. Meaning, like, the demands are here and the military means are here, and every year they're advancing this much, but they're not going to really get here. Does this make sense, at least the way I'm trying to portray it? So, yeah, I don't think that this is going to lead him to the war. Last part. When the war ends, he doesn't need the war. 40% of government spending on defense, a lot of this will continue as a matter of industrial policy. There's going to be a massive rearmament, a huge state armament program that Belousov is trying to push through this August that he's going to lock
Belousov is
in.
the Minister of Defense.
Yes, he's going to lock in for the next 5 years. It's going to be several times larger than the previous state armament programs. The military is going to capture a very large part of the budget for the long term, war or no war. And they will try to then focus on maintaining this large force after the war and the arming this large force. So, to put it this way, trust me, the Russian military does not need this war to continue with state capture resources. They clearly laid out a vision of how they're going to do that. And they got Putin to commit to this vision in December 2022. And they will try to capture a large part of the budget. So the stories like this military just needs this war is not entirely true. Actually, the Russian economy needs defense spending because it oriented more significantly towards defense industrial production and moved labor into that. And they're probably going to find a way to sustain it.
Okay, I don't think that he has resources for that, but that's another subject. Okay, we have, just for a couple of questions. Yes, please. I
Just
see the
his claim,
back.
by the way, I should let you know.
Josh, of course, Josh is the first.
Oh, no. Michael, thanks so much. This was fascinating. I want to try to push in a slightly different direction because I've been listening to all this stuff about Greenland, right? And reading everything in The Economist about the damage, the long-term damage this is doing to
Very different
NATO.
direction, Josh. Let's do
And so, but when you read about all this commentary about long-term damage to NATO that's going on at the moment from what's happening in Greenland, part of that story is, and then it sounds like Russia, and then maybe Russia will probe NATO's defenses and will start launching, that Russia will take advantage of this. This vision of Russia that it's kind of like got this excess military capacity, that it is enjoying seeing NATO kind of struggling in this regard, but that it's positioned to react militarily to opportunities that may present itself in this way to start probing against NATO. That sounds very different from the story that you've told us here today about how the army cannot even keep up with what it's doing in Ukraine at this point in time. So I was just wondering if you could comment a little bit on you on that sort of perception of that's being the story that's being told about Russia's military independent of the war in Ukraine.
Okay, sure. So, like, first, briefly, Greenland. Yes, Greenland is leading to a very significant fracture within the alliance, and people are trying to paper over it. But I was in Brussels only a couple weeks ago. And even though Trump backed down over Greenland, largely due to the markets, not because necessarily of brilliant European resistance, but the more European resistance did, I think, lead to shifts in the markets. It's still a continued issue, and this question hasn't been settled. So it will come back. It is very damaging to the alliance. I want to be clear about that. It's not good. And we're like,
Right. But that's not
all
the
right,
question.
so
The question is this, like, this portrayal of what the
yeah, on
government is.
opportunism. So look, a huge challenge, you have to keep unfortunately two things in mind at the same time. So yes, Russian military is struggling in Ukraine, given how they're fighting now and what's happening in the force. It is also starting to reconstitute. And we can clearly see now that at this level of defense industrial production, not just the material, but looking at the force writ large, they are going to reconstitute quite faster after this war than we thought in 22, 23. And most of us are debating barely between 5, 7 years now. At first, it's thought maybe 10 years to recover. For frontline NATO states like the Baltics, the amount of excess military capacity that Russia needs to pose a real existential threat to them isn't very large. It is available now. As I told you, the Russian military grew substantially in size. If you're a state who only has two brigades as your military, and the rest you depend on NATO reinforcements, the Russian military doesn't need to reconstitute very much for you. It's already a problem the day after the Russia-Ukraine war ends. Okay. But in general, I peg reconstitution to the ability to conduct large-scale combat operations. That's going to take Russia a while. But so you understand, what is a while? In defense planning terms, 10 years or less is a very short amount of time, to be very honest. So if I say we're debating 5 to 7 years, this is not really a debate because it's even not that relevant. These are very narrow margins of differences. And if we look at current Russian military reconstitution, yes, it is a real consideration. I think NATO members are very right to raise this. They're having a challenge, and I'll explain just the challenge I see within NATO, of how to convey this to the public and to political leaders. Why? There is a real need for NATO rearmament, okay? Actually, well beyond the material levels that NATO was at before the war. NATO defense industrial capacity, NATO munitions stored, were very much short of need, okay? How do you convince your publics in states that want to spend on good roads and social welfare and all these other things that, yes, Russia is a danger, Russia is a threat, and okay, maybe 5, 7 years down the line, you don't want to end up in a place where Russian military reconstitutes. You're not certain about American commitments. You're left on the continent with a structural problem in terms of security because you're a revanchist state that's being managed by an increasingly aging person that does not make good risk calculus. Like choices, as we can tell. And you have to hedge against this uncertainty. Okay. So you end up a little bit of a schizophrenic conversation where, on the one hand, you have to make the threat clear for politicians to convince them to make investments now so that you are in the right place years down the line. And this is hard because, as somebody like who works on defense, to me, 10 years is a short amount of time. The politicians, 10 years is a long amount of time. That's other people's problems. They won't be in office then. Okay. How do you convince? Ammunition doesn't vote. People do. Okay. So you go to them and you say, listen, this is very important. You need to make these investments now. They understand social welfare is important for votes. Artillery ammunition and missile production, not nearly as much. I'm sorry. And you have to convince them that they have to do something to be in the right place 7, 8 years from now. Even when they might not be still in office. And that's not easy, Josh. And that's part of the reason for the schizophrenic discussion. Okay, when will Russia pose a threat to NATO? How big is that threat? How do we right-size the Russian threat? And I often get up being in the middle of it as an analyst who has to provide kind of some objective data to referee the conversation. Okay. I hope this answer helps a little bit. And why sometimes you see, and the conversation swings as a pendulum between Russia being 4 feet tall and 12 feet tall, right? So these impressions, and it's now right in the middle. Let's take a few questions.
Yes, please.
Hi.
Yes.
I know a gentleman.
Hey, man. Nice to meet you. Hi. My name is Vladislav Davidson. I'm a Ukraine hand, like my friend here. Three short questions, whichever ones you're interested in. One, talk more about UGVs. When I went to see the head of the Kill House Academy, which is the academy that puts out these guys that are flying, driving these
Yeah.
UGVs. I wasn't sure if it was like a nonsense story or if they're actually putting out enough guys to actually change anything. And most of those people actually were, as you say, IT guys who were really smart who transferred in from other units. There were no new recruits when I went there. So I can't quite understand if UGV is real or nonsense. Two, I don't quite understand, and maybe you can tell me, the Ukrainians took off the ban on leaving the country for 18 to 22 year olds. I don't, when I was on the bus,
Nobody understands. I'll
I
stop right
don't,
there. Nobody in the military understands why. They're
well, not the only
apoplectic
one.
about this decision. Thousands of young people left the country.
I was on the bus. Half my bus was 19-year-olds.
Yeah, it was a
They're
decision
not
by
going to be
Ukraine.
back, those kids. Whatever
Yeah.
they told me on the bus, they're not coming back. So I don't get that. Am I the only one who?
No,
Okay.
you're not the only one. Pretty much everyone in the Ukrainian military has the same questions to the Rada. You're not the only one to raise
Thank you
that.
so much. Okay, and the third and last question is I'm very curious on the quality of the commandants of the major academies that put out the lieutenants and the sergeants, the military academies that actually put out the officer class. Just the one I know was the commander of the Southern Front that we were tooling around in his car in the summer of 22, and he was just a jerk. He was just horrible, and he was so bad that they got to get rid of him so that he stopped picking political fights. They made him the commandant of the
And
Odessa.
your question is?
The question is, the Odessa Military Academy, they put him there because he was just such a jerk.
Yeah.
So, like, are the
Thank
military
you.
academies
I'm
better?
sorry,
Okay.
Andrea. Okay.
All right, briefly, yeah, UGVs are very real. And you see a lot of units using them,
Yes.
and you see them making a real difference, particularly for logistics and casualty evacuation.
Okay.
Okay. UGVs are primarily a conversation about data and units replacing data networks to allow them to be employed. I won't bore everybody with it, but most of the technology is like actually about effectively placing data. And when you're defending basic a relatively static front, it allows you to use UGVs much more effectively. Russians are starting to employ UGVs more, but they didn't use them mostly because they found people expendable, so they just used a guy to drive an ATV for a long time. And they didn't have the same manpower issues. So for them, the technology investment wasn't worth it. Whereas for Ukraine, it's quite worth it because when you have such a deficit of people, you substitute for manpower is technology and capital, okay? Like on the battlefield. It is a real thing, and it is an area where in the lead, and I see it being used successfully by more and more units, and everybody expanding a UGV company and trying to make it even a UGV battalion to the extent they have. But it's different than drones. It's much harder to train for UGVs than drones. People, look, here's the problem. Every military has people that are great, and every military has people that are not great. Okay, trust me. I've spent most of my life like not. I spent some time in the Department of Defense, but working with our military, and it's always a range, okay? And one of the ways by which the military, including the Ukrainian military, gets rid of people who are not good is promoting them. The problem Ukraine had for a long time is at the operational level of command, you had these virtual operators of command staffed with colonels who are not good. Because what militaries typically do, organizations do sometimes too, is if somebody's not good, they say, you know what? You're too good for our unit. They really need your talents at the operational command. You should go there to staff
Michael,
for
cross here.
brigade. You
Yes.
know, you're just too great for us. And then they go, and then you basically see these people in these positions. Same thing academy. The big issue Ukraine has early on in the war, lots of people in these academy were like kind of quite old and sitting out the war. And a lot of people got positions there so they could sit out the war. And there was a big disconnect between what the units need at the front line and the military, senior military academies. And the biggest issues were training as well. Okay, this is a long story. We get too far into it. There are improvements in this area. Biggest challenge Ukraine has is the junior officers, okay? Because too many junior officers get killed. It's a common position to get killed in or wounded. And the force expanded, and they keep getting promoted. So there's not enough of them being made in these academies. That's the bottom line.
Thank you.
Okay, please go.
I know it's touchy, but you gave it a a killed in action range for the Russian side of, like, I believe 350 to 450. I didn't
Yeah.
quite get one a range for the Ukrainian side. I know it's touchy, but can you please give it a range?
I know it's hard. Here's the problem. Both militaries have a large number of people they count as MIA who are KIA in practice, okay? And there's a reason why they have to count them as MIA, missing in action, okay? And these roles are very large on both sides. So if I give you any number, so you understand, if I give you a number for Ukrainian forces, and that number is a lot higher than Zelensky's number. What you should appreciate is that Zelensky's number is right on officially counted KIAs. And my number is also kind of right because there's a very large number of MIAs
Okay.
that are killed in action that will very likely not be seen again, but are not officially listed as KIA. Does this kind of make sense? The discrepancy enough? And Russia has this problem too. Like when this war is over, they will have to acknowledge all the MIAs as KIAs, and they're going to have to potentially pay all these people. The honest answer is I don't know. I haven't looked at it closely recently. It's over 100K for sure. And where it falls in that range, like how much over 100K is debatable. It's quite lower than the Russian number of KIA in my point of view. But if you read reporting by Wall Street Journal and other papers last year, you will find these numbers back then in the ranges of 80 to 90 KK. So at this point, it's probably somewhere in the 100K range. I'm being frank with you. I don't know. I haven't looked at this recently, and I don't want to be quoted on numbers by somebody listening to this where it's something that I don't have any accurate count of. But if you look at reporting even last year, you'll see numbers in that range. Okay, and people might say, no, it's not true, fine. These things are very sensitive, and they're very difficult to kind of get any kind of granular information on. And I try to stay away from them myself for that reason, because it doesn't do anybody any service.
Unfortunately, we have to run up this very interesting conversation, and let's thank, Michael Kaufman for this chat.
Thanks, everyone. Again, sorry I came late. I was gonna wear the jacket and that picture even I had with me. I actually haven't any time to change on my way from the train. So you just have to imagine sartorially what this presentation would have looked like. Okay. Thanks for all the questions. I'm happy to stay a few minutes extra if some people want to ask some more things.
Yeah,
thank
just
you.
it's a quick just a quick announcement. If you enjoyed today's talk, we've got a heavily front-loaded Janelle Abbott's interview series going on this semester. And coming up basically next week on Thursday, February 5th, at the exact same time, Nina Khrushchova will be here. Then every other week for the next 2 weeks after, oh no, every week after, the next week on February 12th, again on Thursday, Michael Talvi will be here. And then on February 26th, we'll have Victoria Nuland here. So just plan on spending your Thursday afternoons here at the Jordan Center with Zhenya for the rest of the month, and you won't go wrong.
And
So,
for sure,
thank you
just
for
fresh out of Moscow. She just returned from Moscow and from her trips around Russia. So that's what's important.